I'm Glenn, also known as the Male Practitioner, and in this podcast, we're talking about real-life practice. With me today, I've got Rachel Macbeth Webb, who's the founder and manager of Beetlewoods Nursery near, I think it's near Coventry, isn't it? Yes. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you, Glenn. Thanks for inviting me to be a part of your fantastic podcast series.
Oh, thank you very much. Now, I know you're going to be talking about outdoor learning and outdoor play, but before that, I'm going to ask you to tell me a little bit about your background in early years.
Oh, it's a really long story because I'm really old, but I'll make it really short. I worked in early years from the moment I left school. So at 18, after my A-levels, I worked in a play group, which is still fairly local to me, Packaway Play Group, and went on from that to be a private nanny. Mm-hmm. My life took me in a lot of different directions, and I had a period where I wasn't actually working in childcare, but raising my own children, and then went to do my early years degree when they were small. And that kind of put my interest back firmly in the early years and made me realise that, you know, I really wanted to go back and work in that kind of environment. So I was fortunate enough after my degree in 2008, I graduated to find a job as a manager of a Packaway preschool, mm-hmm. very local to me as well, and worked there for 7 years before taking the plunge and opening Beetlewoods in 2017.
So it's been quite a journey, quite a leap, really, not a journey, more of a great big leap of faith for you, going from a Packaway setting, which in itself has got lots of barriers. And I know we were talking just before we started this that your garden area was 3 meters by 3 meters. I mean, is that even doable? Yeah. And it, a huge leap. Yeah, that's exactly right. No is the answer. But it's a huge leap of faith for you, wasn't it? Going from that Packaway setting to something completely different.
Yes. And I think when we were talking previously, I said that I didn't have a plan. So when I decided to look to move from that role, I was really looking to set something up that had some outside space somewhere in the local community, but not necessarily an outdoor nursery. And I think it's, as I described it to you before, things just fell into place. And I ended up on a very fortuitous dog walk past the site that is now the home of my nursery. Mm-hmm. And I've walked past this site for many, many months, not knowing that there would be any opportunity there for me to put a building there and open a nursery and have perhaps a nice garden, which I was missing at the Packaway. And everything just sort of slotted into place. I made contact with them, and it was only really after a few weeks of going to the site and seeing the scope of that and thinking about some earlier, I did a master's module at CREC, Centre for Research for Early Childhood, mm-hmm. with Professor Jan White, and it was learning outdoors, the module. Mm-hmm. And I sort of started to think about that module and the work that I did to gather information around the benefits to children of being outside. And I think I just had this moment where I thought, what am I doing? Why don't I just do that? And it has been a really big leap of faith, but I thought other people are doing this. So if other people are doing it, why not? So hence I did it.
I think it has to take at least one brave person to make that leap, and well done for doing it. Brilliant. Because achieved outstanding as well from Ofsted. So it kind of shows the dedication and the passion that you've got behind it in order to achieve that.
Yeah, I think the passion is the thing, isn't it? You can, I meet lots of people, and I think you can lead a team really well when you are a passionate individual and you have a clear vision. And that has really helped me to recruit the staff that work with me, two of whom have been with me for a decade because they worked in my previous setting and said, we don't get what you're doing, but will come along for the ride, and now absolutely wouldn't work in any other way. Yeah. But I think I think that's what saw me through. I was really determined to make a go of it, and if it hadn't worked, and financially if it hadn't worked, and my dear husband had to put up with a lot of agony in the first few months of establishing the nursery, then I'd at least tried, and that was the thing. Mm-hmm. Give it a go and see. So some would call it brave, Glenn, some would call it stupid, but we're here to tell the tale. So
I'll definitely go with brave. I think so. I think if you're going to do something that's out with the mould, it's not stupid, it's brave, because otherwise, how are you going to turn around to yourself later and go, at least I tried?
You know. Yeah, I think you're right.
There's a lot of people out there, a lot of the famous people that if they hadn't have tried, there's a lot of things we wouldn't know about today. Lots of researchers out there have done things that have otherwise been called, you know, daft or stupid or crazy, you know, and, you know, it's kind of the norm now because of it. And so maybe even going as far as possibly calling yourself a bit of a pioneer or one of the pioneers, we'll say.
Take that challenge down. I think that's the thing. And when I began to think about the journey to an outdoor nursery, because it was quite a quick thing, I found the site and then within 6 months we were open. It was probably good that it was that quick. I didn't have any real ideas other than I wanted to get children outside about what the nursery would look like. I didn't try and think about what a day would look like, what an hour would look like. I just wanted to give it a go and see. And that was tricky at the beginning, because although I had my team, you know, it's enabling parents to understand why that's important. So the team were like, yeah, okay, we'll be outside. So I didn't have that kind of concern that I wouldn't be able to have people around me that understood that being outside was a good thing, or want to be outside in all weathers. And believe you me, in 3 years, we've seen just about every weather system we could possibly have seen. Never mind a global pandemic, but it was thinking about parents. And I remember in the early days, parents would call and say, "We're really interested in your nursery. Can you tell us a bit about it?" And I would think, right, okay, what am I actually going to tell them? And I was very, very honest about it and said that I felt the important thing was to connect children with nature, give them a sense of awe and wonder. And actually, we've lost touch with that a lot. And it was really important to me that parents understood that was the fundamental reason for doing what I was doing, but also that I didn't really know yet how this would pan out. And we did start with three children. You know, on one day we'd have three children and three staff. That was, you know, it was a worrying time. You know, you've got to, even with self-belief, I was told I was, you know, a bit foolish at the beginning by many people, but not having the parents buying into the idea was really scary. But true to form, by the January, we opened in September 17, and by January we had enough children to pay our bills. Not to pay me, but to pay our bills, which, you know, was a fantastic place to be in three months in. And from there, it's just snowballed. It's just grown and grown and grown. And we've really found our feet with it now.
Do you think that's down to kind of your passion, but also the passion of the team that's kind of pushed that on? Because, I mean, to be 3 months in, and like you say, you didn't pay you, but that's not unusual when you start a new nursery.
No.
But to be able to pay the bills and to pay your staff, that's quite an amazing feat. So do you think it is down to that uniqueness of the setting that you run, but also down to the passion of yourself and your team?
I totally think it's a combination of everything. You know, I couldn't do the work I do, as mad and passionate and bonkers as I am about early years. You know, not everybody is going to be like that, and I don't expect my staff to have it written through them like a piece of rock as I do. However, yes, you know, the most fundamental thing we did in the early days, aside from walking alongside the children, was we developed our pedagogical approach, our vision and our practice together. You know, we talk about agency, don't we, for children? Well, absolutely, the children have agency in the nursery with one another. They have a real sense of belonging, but the staff absolutely do. And, you know, you need a team that can think outside of the box and also let go for a bit, because we definitely had to let go at the beginning and think, this isn't like our old setting. It's nothing like it. We've got to work with different parameters, different variables. And also, we don't want it to be the same. We want to just tease this out and see where it leads us. And that was an absolute privilege. I feel that was the fundamental reason we've had the success that we've had in terms of the progress for children, the well-being for children, the staff, is because we had that privileged moment where we didn't inherit something else. We started from a completely blank canvas. And I'll always feel really grateful for that moment and that opportunity to do that and to share that with the team. And we've worked, you know, we're still a work in progress, but the vision and values that we find are important for each individual member of staff and our parents, our stakeholders, we've considered all of those. And that's, in my mind, that's why it works for everybody who comes into the nursery and has an association with the nursery, simply because we've taken account of all those, all their opinions, all their feelings, their thoughts, and actually really harshly examined what we want. You know, what do we want our nursery to be? And it's not just my idea, it's everybody's, and you're absolutely right when you mention that. That's intrinsic.
There's an investment from them then. It's not just, they don't just work there. They're part of it. They're part of the whole ethos, part of the whole machine that makes it run.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why having that time to really think about and reflect on the days when we closed the gates and looked at one another and said, what did we do today? Oh my goodness me. We played hide and seek. We climbed in the trees. We played hide and seek again. We swung on the hammocks. And there were many moments in those early days where we all thought, hang on, is this enough? What is enough? What mm-hmm. do we need to be doing? So that's when the work around our own personal and professional values really came into play. Because when you start to unravel that, you start thinking, well, actually, what do I want? Well, I want to be loved and nurtured. Well, we're pretty sure the families that we come into contact with will want that. How are we going to demonstrate that? What's that going to look like in our everyday practice? How can we show and demonstrate to anybody who walks into our nursery that that's what we hold dear? And we just unpicked it all, you know, and it's now like it's a whole web, like a spider's web that just runs through everything that we do. Every minute of every day has this, you know, woven tapestry, if you like, underneath it that just supports everybody and all their practice and the children, and the fun that they want to have, and the parents who lean on us for advice and support. Mm-hmm. It sounds really idyllic when I'm describing it. And actually, we're really fortunate because, okay, not every day is fantastic. You know, we have rain, torrential rain for days on end, and that poses challenges. We have children who, you know, find it difficult maybe to separate, as all nurseries do, and mm-hmm. that's challenging. Or staff that simply say, oh, right, you know, I'm having a bad day, like any setting does. But it is, we are really, really fortunate to have created that from nothing, which is, as you say, it involves everybody.
Amazing. So it's obvious then you've got a passion for being outdoors and the learning that can take place outdoors. What kind of advice and things have you got for other practitioners out there that might be considering or wanting to develop their own practice in terms of using the outdoors? What kind of advice have you got for them?
Well, I think, again, we discussed this a bit before, I think there are often barriers. So some of the barriers will be around health and safety, mm-hmm. risk. Do practitioners have adequate clothing to go outside? So if you're expecting your team to go outside in all weathers, what do they have to wear? You know, nobody likes to be cold. I hate being cold, and I hate even more being cold and wet. So we spent a lot of time thinking about trying different wellies, trying different boots, trying different coats. It's only in the last 6 months, or just before Christmas, that we found the perfect solution in this sea fishing get-up that's not particularly attractive, don't get me wrong, but it's thermal and it's waterproof and it's brilliant, absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. So I think addressing the barriers, so getting your team on side. So if you want to explore your outside space, ensuring that everybody has that sense of agency we've just mentioned, and really unpicking what you want to achieve by taking the children outside. Once you've kind of got that in place, I think the biggest thing is to have a clear vision. So, okay, we're going outside because it's really good for us. It's, you know, nature, you know, children looking at bugs, it's just a really good thing. But I think stepping back a bit is the key. It's easy to take the sand tray from the, you know, the nursery and put it in the outside mm-hmm. space. And there's nothing wrong with that. But actually, we need to sort of think about, do we want to replicate the indoors, outdoors? And actually, the outdoors is unique. It's special. It creates and evolves a different level, like we were saying earlier, a deeper, richer level of engagement that is unique to the outdoors. And that's where I think it's really important not to do the, okay, we've got these tables and chairs, let's put them outside. Children need to be active. So just providing lots of open-ended experiences. We've got a mud kitchen. We've also got a couple of hammocks, a rope swing, some big tyres, and we don't plan anything. So the biggest thing I think you can learn from letting children outside, particularly at the beginning, is to let them go outside, provide some open-ended stuff, not loads, mm-hmm. and just watch them. Watch them, observe them, just see how they engage with that environment, see the sorts of things they're doing. Lots of temptation to take things like, you know, let's make something out of a stick. Well, that's fine if that's what a child's chosen to do. But ultimately, you know, this is the difference. There's not an activity as such that we would ever do outside unless it's been driven by the child's choice. If a child comes to us and says, I want to make this, of course we're going to help them. But actually, we wouldn't set up an activity, say, with clay and say, right, we're all going to make a clay hedgehog because, you know, we're in the woods and it's the thing we should be doing. We stay away from that in the belief that children need to be driving that for themselves and really empowering them to choose. So I think the biggest thing is getting everybody to understand why. So if it's something you've not been doing, you know, what do you think? And getting everybody's opinion on that. And then thinking about initially just letting it happen. And a lot of nurseries have said to me, a lot of practitioners have said to me, oh, you know, but my senior management team, they want plans. They want a plan of what we're going to do when we get out there. And I say, you know, be brave. There's a lot of research that suggests that not just outside, inside too. Letting children be, because we've got wrapped up in this mad, crazy world, is actually the right thing to do. Mm. And letting children be children and having the childhood they deserve by empowering them to choose is the right way. You know, it's difficult because you feel like as practitioners, you should have control over certain situations. And I'm a great believer in rewriting that and letting the children have that. And that's how we work. So we don't interfere in children's play. We wait to be invited. Yeah. It's taken us ages to work like that because the natural, what's your natural, as a practitioner, you'll know, what's your go-to thing?
You want to join in with them. But I suppose you could liken that, you know, we just jump straight into the children's play without even considering it. It's the equivalent of, you know, you're walking down the street and there's two adults having a conversation, you just jump in and join in with them. Why would you do that? Well, equally, why would you jump into children's play when you haven't been invited? You know, they're busy. Right. They're doing what works for them. And we're going in and upsetting all of that.
Exactly. And I, you know, when we come back to thinking about a children's rights-based way of working, the way I describe that is very similar to the way you've just described it, in that it's really rude and disempowering. You know, I'm playing with my friend. I'm in the mud kitchen. I'm creating something fantastic. And this big burly practitioner comes along dressed in their sea fishing gear and says, what are you doing? Oh, hello? You can see what I'm doing. I'm making a mud pie. And actually, what do we as practitioners want to know? Not what they're doing, what they're thinking. And by watching children, we can find that out. You know, we watch them for sustained periods of time. We remain accessible, but we're not in there. So having that moment where we just, you know, we're sitting on a log and we're just sort of in the corner of our eye, we're not really looking like we're paying attention. We're hearing all the language. We're hearing the conversation, the collaboration. Maybe there's a bit of conflict resolution. You know, they're working that out for themselves. We're not jumping in on that. We're letting them, you know, tease that out for themselves and really think about strategies to solve problems. There's so much information in that we don't need to be in it constantly asking questions and disempowering children. I've got a member of staff who came from school. She joined the team last year and she was a TA and she left school because she felt really stifled in her belief that children should be outside, but also their creativity, you know, their ability to choose. When you're getting a four-year-old who's crying their eyes out to try and write a sentence in reception and they don't want to do it, that's heartbreaking. So she left and she came to work with me and she said, I find it really difficult to not ask. So when a child's digging something, I find it really hard to go in and not say, what are you doing? Oh, what's that? Oh, what colour's this? And all those obvious questions we've all done it. You know, we've all been that practitioner. I know I definitely have. And it's really lovely because a year on now, she says to me, you know, sometimes I'll still go to do it. But now I sort of count in my head to like five. What am I doing? And it's because five practitioners definitely felt that they weren't proactive enough. So if they weren't asking lots of questions and testing children, for want of a better word, they weren't doing enough. And actually, we just had to strip that right back and say, well, why? What is our why? Why are we doing this? And when we did that, it was really obvious to see that when we took the brakes, you know, we took the step back and put the brakes on and said, well, actually, we're not going to work like that anymore. Let's just try it. The benefits were huge to children's well-being. Children's self-esteem, their levels of resilience are high. They leave us with really good levels of self-esteem. You know, their confidence bubbles are intact. they feel they can make mistakes, because grappling and struggling, as I said to Kate in the last podcast I did, are good things. You know, it's good to grapple, it's good to struggle with something. And then you might need to say, excuse me, can you help me? And then at that point we would go in and mm-hmm. of course we would model, demonstrate, you know, yeah. assist. And they're the key things. And I think there's a big temptation to intervene when actually, again, it comes down to the trust, you know, trusting small children, trusting them to decide and not thinking that as grown-ups we know best. They're motivated. They're already motivated to be yeah. curious and learn. It's adults often that stifle that, not the other way around.
Definitely. I mean, I know, like, talking about my previous setting where we had a big outdoor area and it was very sort of forest school style. I'm not going to say it was forest school because we weren't, but it was equally that bit where we were talking there. It's like, I would just stand back and just watch what they're up to, and I wouldn't question. And I remember there was two children, and they were gathering leaves and whatever pine cones and things that had fallen on the ground. And they were going to make it, be like, oh, what we're going to put it in. And it's like, hang on, I can help, but without interfering. And I went along and I got one of the big pots from the mud kitchen and I just popped it down on the ground near them. And I stepped back again. And I think it is kind of what we need to do. We do have that need almost to kind of go and jump in. It's like, right, I can save the day for you. No, just don't upset the whole rhythm that they've got going.
And that's it, you know, the children, the rhythm is so important. The rhythm of play for children is so important. And, you know, you risk so much by stepping in. And it's such a fine, delicate balance, because, of course, there are times when, as humans, we don't even think about it and we get involved. We just, mm-hmm. you know, we'll go wandering over and think, maybe, you know, maybe we can add something. And I've, you know, I've absolutely done that and probably still continue to do that in some situations now. It takes a lot to stop me from, you know, I have to think about it, even as an experienced practitioner, to why am I doing it? What are my reasons for doing it? And is this the kind of play that they want, just simply because I might suggest it? And yesterday was a prime example. My apprentice, he's built a house out of a tree that we had felled on site because it, in the winds we had, it fell. And he took all the branches off, it sawed them off, and he made a house. So it hasn't got a roof, but it's just got walls and a door between some trees. So yesterday, one of the children said to me, can you come in the house with me? So I said, yeah, of course. So we sat in the house, and she said, oh, that seat's a bit low for you, isn't it? It was a log, it was a small log, it was low mm-hmm. for me. So I'll go and get you another one. So she came, she got a bucket, not a wheelbarrow, a bucket, and put filled the bucket. She got it to me and she was like, oh, I don't know how I'm going to get it out of the bucket now because the handle's in the way. She tipped it over, she pumped it down. She went, that's for your bottom, you can sit there. So I sat there, I didn't do anything, I didn't go and get a book, I didn't, mm-hmm. oh, should we do this, should we do that? And then about five children came in and said, this is the Three Little Pigs house and it's made of bricks and he's the wolf. We need a fire quick. So the bucket became, and they did all of this. I didn't drive any of it. They made a bucket and they pretended there was hot water in there. The wolf came down, burnt his bottom and ran out, so he didn't blow the house down. And this went on for about 45 minutes. And my role in that was so minimal. They didn't need me. They just took their imagination to mm-hmm. a completely different place based on some of the things they know, some of the things they're interested in. And so all these children came and got involved that weren't there originally, simply because they thought, oh, that looks like a bit of fun. I'm going to kind of go and get involved in that.
It was natural curiosity, really, isn't it? But then there's equally that information sharing. Like you were saying, like some of them knew the story of the Three Little Pigs or whatever. So they're all having input. Again, it's going back to like staff we were saying about staff having input. Well, it's equal with the children there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were there, but actually you weren't part of it as such. You were just there in the background. But it was like the children had that input and built up this whole imaginative play.
Yeah, they didn't need me. It was almost literally like I was part of the furniture. It wasn't, but it was interesting because at some point I left the environment. I can't think what happened now. I needed to go and do something and I left it and I went into the caravan to get a piece of paper somebody asked me for. And two of the children that had been in that engaged imaginative play, I mean, they're not bothered with the caravan at all because obviously we don't need to use it. It's locked. They never go in there. And they actually came and I could hear them asking other members of staff where I'd gone. And they went, oh, she's in there. And they came in and they were like, are you coming out? You know, it was the, it was their invitation to me to go back and play, which, you know, that's that sounds really simplistic when you say it, but it's so special because that's their agenda. I'm respecting their right to play in the way they choose rather than having some idea about what that might look like. So we have a completely, you know, unstructured environment. Children choose when they eat their lunch. They can, if they want their lunchbox out at 10 o'clock, well, it's up to you. It's your lunch. If you want to eat something out of your lunchbox, that's absolutely fine. And in times of COVID, you know, we're not providing fruit and snack and things at the moment simply because we're in a wood and children tend to eat an apple one bite and put it back in the box and somebody else picks it up. So, you know, they're going and helping themselves. And that's, you know, again, it's their Maslow's hierarchy, isn't it? What do I need right now? I'm tired. I'm cold. I need to go to sleep in a hammock. I need some food. So actually, I'll go into my lunchbox. I'll make an executive decision. Mm-hmm. Just because I'm two doesn't mean I can't do that. I can absolutely do that, provided I've got an adult that can support me with it. And that doesn't mean the adult chooses. It means the adult just maybe helps me with a zip on my lunchbox. Mm-hmm. So, you know, each day the children come in and they are absolutely within our space. And I don't think I would have had the courage or perhaps the experience to have done that in my previous nursery. I think having the flexibility that an outdoor space can provide means that you, as a practitioner, start looking at other ways that you can work and other ways that you can develop a unique approach. And it might be nurseries will have, you know, it's really helpful, I think, to have an outdoor policy. So what are the expectations around being outside, which could be helpful if you've got perhaps leadership teams that aren't sure about being outside or practitioners that aren't sure, having a policy and really having a look at your outdoor space and thinking, okay, what's it got in it? What do we actually need? And is it safe? Because, you know, we touched on that. It is important that it's safe, but it's also important that you provide risk for children to manage for themselves. We've got huge containers on site and they're like old water containers that aren't of our choosing. They're just there because the site is used for other things at the weekends. And the children, they're bigger than the children. They've got metal straps around the sides and the children would all of the time want to climb them. And for the first 3 months we were there, they climbed them. And then we went back after Christmas and this one child stood on the top and she said, I want to jump off. And I remember thinking, oh my word. I don't actually know whether you can do that because I don't know you that well. You've just started yesterday. And inside I was like, shall I let her do it? Or what do I do? Have you got a plan? So instead of, you know, the be careful, you know, and purveying my worry onto her and my anxiety about whether she could or not, I just remained close. So if the worst happened, my arms would go out and I would catch her. And she did it. And then about five others wanted to do it. And it was this big thing then. We'd climb up and jump off. But actually, how empowering is that for the children to do it? And then they had, you know, their chests were puffed out when they finished. And you could see the pride that they felt about being able to try something new and work it out and work that their feet had to be in a certain position and all of those things that we can get beyond if we all have a common acceptance about what we're going to do. So what's acceptable for me might not be the same as a member of staff feels it's acceptable. So working that out at the beginning is really helpful. So what are our sort of hidden rules, if you like? So you know, are you comfortable with that? Well, I'm not. Well, okay, can we find a common ground? You don't want to climb up that high. What should we say we're comfortable with? And that's been another real eye-opener for me, that you empower children to take risk in a way that is, obviously, we're there, we're supervising, the benefits of that in terms of developing resilience, you know, the characteristics of effective learning. You know, I love those far more than I love anything else in the development matters. And that's not to slight the development matters. I love the document if it's used right, correctly. But I think the characteristics of effective learning, to see those, and that's the other thing that underpins our work. If they're there and you're really thinking about enabling children to work things out, problem solve, have a go, you know, and not worry about the outcome, they're the things that when inevitably they go on to school, for some of our children that go on to school, a lot of them have deferred this year, but they will eventually go into school. If they've got a good sense of self and have got good levels of self-esteem and resilience and independence, they'll find the transition in our previous experience a lot easier. And when someone says to them, you know, you need to sit down, they know because they've had embodied experiences where the bottom is. You know, for some children, that doesn't develop until much later because they need those all whole body experiences to know that. And they're labelled as fidgeters or, you know, your child's got a problem because they can't sit still. Well, actually, we weren't programmed to sit still, were we?
No.
So
definitely. I mean, I think as well, it's kind of like, it's kind of going back to that kind of conversations at the start that everyone has with each other, particularly the practitioners, in knowing what your comfort zone is, and maybe it's pushing yourself slightly out of it, but not enough to make you completely freak out. I mean, we had that conversation before that, you know, you've got to be engaged, but you've got to be comfortable and secure with it, that, you know, as a practitioner, in order to make it work, in order to be kind of as a team and work together on it. So I think it's kind of bearing in mind what everyone is comfortable with. So like you're saying about, you know, jumping off that big tank, you know, one practitioner might be, yeah, that's fine, I've got you covered on this one. Another one will be, whoa, I can't do it. And again, I think it's part of that team ethic that you've got to know each other's strengths and areas that aren't as strong.
It's the key to everything. It underpins everything. And I couldn't have the nursery practicing in the way it is without everybody being on side. And it comes back to that same thing, you know, and I talk about this a lot in every podcast I ever speak in, a webinar I do, but it comes down to that clear vision, the clear pedagogical approach. What are your aims? Why do you want to do that? And if everybody who comes into your setting, newly recruited staff, even before they're recruited, we talk to them about our vision, our values, our ethic, why we do things the way we do, and actually really openly say to them, how do you feel about that? Because, you know, we can talk to them about risk management on a daily basis. We can talk to them about assessments. We can talk about observations. But actually, if they don't have an intrinsic belief that the way we work is the way they believe childhood should be, and actually maybe we're not the right setting for them. And so that all helps. So with a view of outdoors, you know, it's easy for me, because when parents send their children to my nursery and where practitioners choose to work with us, they know that's what we are. So we're outdoors all day, every day. We don't have a building. This is the way we are. So you know this when you send your child to us or you choose to work with us. However, settings that don't have that, it's almost more difficult for them to bridge that gap and really appreciate why they should go outside. And you're absolutely right. Having your team, you know, as part of the initial reasons for, and if you're not using your outside space as much, why is that? Let's have a think about, you know, what were our own childhood experiences of being outside like? You know, did you go and make dens in the wood, or did you not have a garden? You know, what's your own educational experience taught you about being outside? All those things are so important. And I've got a really diverse team. I've got staff that have been home educated since the age of 12. I've got parents of my staff team who've got autistic children and have had completely different educational experiences themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think it's so important and so fantastic to get all of that experience and harness it to the best of your capability. And we will all have bias. We will all have worries and concerns and things that have happened in our lives that make us like that. So developing a clear vision for us, and it probably took us a good 18 months to really work out. We kept revisiting it. What is it we want to do? And why is it we want to do that? And what have we learned from having that child in our setting? Actually, that didn't work, did it? Well, we need to perhaps think about that tomorrow. And really reflecting is the key, because it is never perfect. And I would hate it to be perfect, because it would mean that my job is no more. You know, I love the spinning plates thing. You know, you get one going and you run over. That's part of early years, isn't it?
Absolutely. Whether you're an outdoor nursery or whether you're, you know, a basic template nursery, it's still the same thing. You're still juggling 1,000 things at once. I think one thing I was kind of thinking about as well was, you know, we're kind of finally starting to wake up more to the use of open-ended resources and things like that. And a lot of nurseries are buying in these resources, but actually yours are on tap, really, aren't they? That it's what you have around you. You're talking about, like, we talked about these elderflower berries and things like that, and you've got the different leaves and the trees, and yeah, you've got those tanks and you've got the logs, and it's all there. And that's why I feel, you know, because I said to you before this as well, that children in my previous setting were much more connected and engaged outside in that particular garden, because I didn't have the Duplo, and I didn't have, you know, the home corner, and it was there. They had the mud kitchen, but it was you know, they had to go off and find these logs, or we had tires and planks and all that. And I think that's kind of another reason why I think for you as well, you know, it probably works, because the children have to think about it and engage in a different way.
And that's exactly how it is. Each day is, I always use the phrase children potter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that conjures up in my mind, you know, of a very stereotypical, you know, of my mum pottering in her garden. You know, she's in her 70s, and in lockdown, she's just been pottering from, you know, that flower bed to this. She's had a garage knocked down. She's got a project, and she potters. And I'll say to her, "What have you done today, mum?" "Sure, I've been pottering in the garden." And this resonates with me at nursery, mm-hmm. because I often see children doing exactly that. And they might potter for a bit in the mud kitchen, then go and think, "Oh, I need a bit of a, you know, a step back now. I'm going to go and sit in a hammock." And they might be in a hammock for 40 minutes, but actually, that's great, isn't it? They're choosing that. So mm-hmm. fantastic. Self-regulation, here we go. You know, I'm deciding that's what I need right now. But you're right. We started with really one tiny mud kitchen that my husband made out of some pallets, and we've only got ones that he's made. You know, we've got... Mm-hmm. stuff that people have given us, but actually we need very little. And you're spot on when you say that the less stuff you have, you're not prescribing a way of play, you're enabling a way of play yeah. that they choose. And that's, it makes for the most amazing, just to watch it is amazing. It's phenomenal to see children just make choices and how they decide to use something that you haven't given them a prescription for. And I think, you know, I love Duplo, don't get me wrong. You know, you can do loads of things with Duplo, including making guns, as we were discussing earlier.
Yeah.
And, you know, if there isn't one available and you're not allowed to use one, then you're going to make one out of Duplo, whether you want to or not. But I think, you know, there's a place for not taking indoor toys outside. It's not the right thing to do in terms of, it's a special, special thing, and it should remain so. And it doesn't matter what you've got. I've got tyres that I got from a garage up the road. They just delivered me 3 or 4 tyres. And the children sometimes sit in them, stack them. They sometimes just don't even use them at all. But they're there, and it's just an opportunity to play with them if they want to. And everything is an opportunity. Everything they're doing all day is an opportunity for learning. And that's the thing. You know, that's the key.
Definitely. I think as well... You kind of touched on a wee bit as well. It was like, you know, using something like, well, we talked about it before. It was like using a stick and, you know, sitting the child down to say, right, we're going to make something with a stick. Boom, you've instantly closed it off, I think, as well. And it's like, but I've had children come up to me with a stick and, yeah, as I say, we've had a gun. But equally, I've had a child come up to me and go, you know, casting a spell with it. They become this witch or wizard, and it's casting that spell. And I think as well, going back to what you said about pottering, there's nothing wrong with pottering. And pottering is an amazing word, because pottering is actually a slow, careful, thought-out concentration of the task at hand. I think we're guilty in a lot of childcare settings. And we're bang, bang, bang. We're rushing from one thing to another to another. And yeah, I admit it. Yeah, we do it in my own setting, because we have to be... you know, tennis for a certain time or swimming for a certain time. Yeah, oh my goodness, it's snack time. Ah, you know, stop. And it's like potter more. Absolutely potter more. And I think it's an amazing word, and I think we should use it more often in early years.
It just conjures up to me when I look around the setting and see it happening. That's the word that comes to mind. And I think we are in this crazy world from when babies first arrive on a massive rush. You know, we're all on a rush. We all need to be somewhere, like you said, and we all have to get them walking, get them talking, get them out of nappies, you know. And actually, it's okay. It's not just okay. It's actually right to be a baby, to be 2, to be 3, to be whatever age. It's time to be. You know, there are times when I really just want to be today. I just want to be in that moment and be me. I don't want to think about the fact that when I leave work, I've got to go and do X, Y, and Z, or tomorrow I've got to go and take a test, or, you know, whatever. I just want to have that moment. And I've learned so much from the children, because I'm not very good at being in the moment. I'm always thinking what I've got to do or what I should have done. And actually, I've learned so much from them. So seeing them have unrushed, uninterrupted, unhurried time, to the point where, you know, sometimes we'll get to 12:30 and nobody's actually want their lunch. Well, and then we have other days, well, like I said, at 11 o'clock, is it lunchtime? You know, we really want our lunch now. We're starving. We've been outside for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So it's just having that. And I appreciate we're lucky that we can do that. But actually, is it? it's actually something we've created because we believe it's the right thing, and the benefits we've seen have been huge. So I suppose it's a bit of both, really. I'm not saying it's down to it can be done everywhere, or it's down to the fact that we've put these things rigidly in place. It's actually the opposite. It's a background that's just said, well, actually, what do you want to do, and how does this look? And that's worked so well for us. And children respond so well to having time. Mm-hmm. You know, their parents are often rushing them in the mornings. I would, you know, not be one bit surprised. You know, quick, we've got to get out of the house, or you know. When they pick them up, they might have to go somewhere else. And, you know, life is one big rush. And sometimes it's just nice to close the gates at work, at the nursery. And it's just our bubble. It's our, I know that word's being used a lot at the moment. I don't mean it in that way.
But no, but I know what you mean. It's your own space, your own world almost.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Therein lies it. It's that moment when on Monday we opened the gates for the first time, and it was really emotional, you know, having not seen our families for nearly 3 months. It was, and it was extraordinary. They just ran in. Every child ran in. And this is 3 months, you know, and this is bonkers. This is mad. But, you know, they feel so secure and they feel so safe, and it doesn't feel like nursery, I guess. It just feels like I'm coming to some fantastic, wonderful, secret garden-esque place that is full of opportunity for me when I'm ready to do it. And if I'm not, and I want to spend all day hanging off a rope swing or in a hammock or climbing a tree, that's okay. It's more than okay.
It's the right thing to do. Sounds like an amazing adventure, and I think I want to come and have an adventure with you at some point.
You must.
Definitely. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for your time today. It's been amazing to talk to you.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, Glenn.